Are we on? Ouch. I wonder if it's this thing here. Okay, if we can find our seats, that'd be good. We want to transition to to New Testament. And I've decided to, again, what I'm basically hunting and pecking through the book, you know, picking out a few things from the book, both in what we already did and, of course, in terms of what we're going to do. If you are familiar with the book, you know that we basically barely scratched the surface, but it's okay. We're just trying to hit some major ideas just to give you an idea, again, of how biblical people were reading their own Bible, what they were thinking when they wrote it, what the original audience was thinking when they read it, some of the things that are easy for us to miss if we're not reading closely, or if we sort of lack the worldview framework for what we are reading, what we do come across. And so it's going to be more of the same when we hit the New Testament. We have to have sort of an Old Testament context for this. Some of that we've hit on already, but I want to begin here with Jesus and the Gospels by throwing in one Old Testament item that is helpful for the things I've pulled out in relation to the Gospels as we, you know, move on this afternoon. So this word, Bashan, it's a transliteration of the Hebrew term, Bashan. This is a word that to the Old Testament Israelite would have made their skin crawl a little bit because of the place that it referred to and the associations of that place. And that place and its associations are going to, again, bleed into the Gospels in certain episodes of Jesus' life. Bashan was a region in the Promised Land. I have a couple graphics, but here is the region of Bashan. Here's the Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee. This is the region of Bashan right in here. In terms of tribal allotments, a lot of it's the tribe of Manasseh. A little bit more of a close-up here. This is the extent of the conquest under Joshua in green. And you'll notice here that we've got Bashan. The territory of Bashan is going to really be this whole sort of circular area. Pharpar River, we want to remember that because of something we're going to see on another map. And draw your attention to two cities, Ashtaroth and Edrei, that are in the region of Bashan. And these two locations and certain Old Testament events are going to give Bashan its flavor and what it meant to a biblical person. Again, in terms of tribal allotment, you can see it's basically Manasseh territory. Here's the same river up here. You'll notice in the tribal allotment here that is Manasseh that encompasses Bashan, we have here at the top Mount Hermon. Okay, that will be a significant point of geography. Here is Edrei, which we saw on the other map. Ashtaroth is up here. Now, if you look at some of the passages that concern this place, Deuteronomy 1:4, Sihon, this is, or in Hebrew, Sihon, the king of the Amorites who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan. If you know anything about Og, again, you're already sort of starting, okay, I know why this place creeped people out. You'll notice here the phrase, Og, who lived in Ashtaroth and Edrei. So this is Og's region right around here, and Sihon is going to be operating in this region. They're elsewhere called the two kings of the Amorites. The Amorites, that was a term that was also equated with the term Rephaim, which, again, was one of the terms used to describe the variety of the giant clans in the Old Testament. We go to Joshua 9, two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon and Og of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth. And then Joshua 12:4, you have them referenced again. Something graphically going on here. Sorry for that. Og, king of Bashan, one of the remnant of the Rephaim who lived at Ashtaroth and Edrei. Basically, Bashan was Rephaim territory. And at least Og, because of the reference to his bed here, okay, 9 cubits in length, 4 cubits in breadth, at least Og was, again, one of the remnant of the Rephaim. He was unusually tall. And I'm not going to go through all the passages in Deuteronomy 2 and Deuteronomy 3 and Numbers 13 and all, you know, Joshua 12, other places in Joshua during the conquest about the giant clans, but this region was known specifically for this stuff and for more. Bashan was, I guess in most blunt terms, hell to the Canaanites. Ashtaroth and Edrei, those two cities that show up in the Bible, also show up by name in Canaanite texts, specifically Ugaritic texts, as gateways to the underworld. They were the gates of hell. Okay, they were associated with the place where Baal ruled, because Baal in Canaanite religion was Lord of the Dead. If you know anything about the Baal cycle, the Baal literature of Ugarit, the basic story is that El, who was the lead god of the Canaanite pantheon, had a co-ruler that could be competed for. He was a vice regent, and various gods fought over it. Baal eventually emerges as the winner in their religious texts by defeating Mot, which is the Hebrew word for death. So Baal was viewed as Lord of the Dead, Lord of the Underworld, Lord of Hell. It's very easy to see how Baal becomes a Satan figure, you know, in biblical literature. Baal-zebul, Baal-zebub. Baal-zebul in Ugaritic means Prince Baal. There's Baal-zebul. Zebul is the word for prince, Prince Baal. It's a title of Baal. And again, that language, that term, that descriptive phrase gets attributed to the devil in biblical thinking, in Israelite thinking. So this is not a good place. These are not good associations. In the underworld, of course, you have the Rephaim. Anybody who read an article of mine appeared less than a week ago on the Logos Talk Forum entitled, Where Do Demons Come From? You actually don't get a clear, you know, very simple answer in the biblical text as far as the origin of demons. People think that, well, they're fallen angels. Well, guess what? The angels who fell in Genesis 6 are never called demons in either testament. In all the religious texts of the day, especially Second Temple period, intertestamental Jewish literature, and in Second Peter, the angels that sinned back at that event are imprisoned. They are in the abyss. Or as Peter says, they were put in chains and imprisoned until the time of the end, chains of gloomy darkness, all that kind of stuff. They're not the demons that run around in the Gospels that possess people and stuff like that, because they're not free to do that. These are different entities. You know, I don't want to rabbit trail too far into that, but if you actually look at the underworld concept in the Old Testament, the place known as Sheol, the Rephaim show up there. They are denizens. They are inhabitants of the underworld, sort of under the thumb, as it were, or at least in cahoots with the Lord of the Dead, who in Canaanite religion is Baal. In biblical thinking, it's Satan, it's the devil. So all of these associations are inescapably linked to this region of Bashan. Bashan, as I pointed out, is also where Mount Hermon is. Mount Hermon in Second Temple Jewish literature is the place where the watchers, the sons of God in Genesis 6 descend and hatch their plot to rebel against God, you know, transgression of heaven and earth, you know, with human women, however that worked. We could, I talk about that a lot in the book. There is actually two supernatural views of Genesis 6, not just one. But again, skipping all those details now, this is the place that became associated with them to, you know, the Jewish community of Jesus' day. This is what they're thinking when they look at Hermon. This is what they're thinking when they look at Bashan, the region that Hermon is in. In Hebrew, Hermon is a geographical term for the mountain, and it's also related to Karem. Karem, Karam, that's the verb that means to devote to destruction. It's Israelite holy war term in the conquest. Why is it associated with them? Well, because the Rephaim, the Anakim, and these other giant clans descend from the Nephilim, who are the descendants of these guys. They need to be exterminated to inhabit the land. This is why, and again, you can get hints of it in scholarly literature, but it's really, really hard to find outside my book, actually. I don't view the Canaanite conquest as an indiscriminate genocide. You know, unbelievers and people who are really, you know, sort of hateful to scripture, that this is one of the first places they go. Oh, you know, the God of all that killing and just genocidal. No, if you actually understand what you're looking at, if you actually look at the terminology, here's what you find. There's a wide range of verbs used for the conquest, what the Israelites were supposed to do. There's drive out, expel, dispossess, you know, take as your inheritance, that kind of stuff. They're all different Hebrew verbs. One of them is to devote to destruction. That's the Harem terminology. It's really interesting, and I don't think coincidental, that every place that you see Harem mentioned specifically during the conquest, it's at a place or in a region where the Israelites earlier, under Moses and Joshua, ran into Anakim, giant clans. This is why Joshua, at the end of the conquest, defines victory as this: there were no more Anakim in the land. They were put to destruction. And it all goes back to Genesis 6, which is a passage within evangelicalism. Again, we strip of any supernatural character. Oh, it's the sons of Seth and the sons of, you know. We make them human. We make them people. We explain it away because we don't like the supernatural feel to it. That is not the way a biblical person looked at any of that stuff. If you strip away the supernatural character of it, you not only violate its own original context, which I go into in great detail in the book, it has a Mesopotamian context. And you will find stuff on that only in this book. And that's not because Mike's so smart. Okay, the reason is Mike has the benefit of a guy who, in 2010, who was an expert in Mesopotamian cuneiform, decided to go through all the tablets that pertain to the flood and see if he could find parallels to the first four verses, the ones that everybody sort of looks over. And guess what? He found lots of stuff, put it in an article, and I've read the article. Okay, it's only 2010, so all of your commentaries that you use when you get to Genesis 6 and it starts talking about the sons of God and the Nephilim and, oh, they're just people, they're just this, they're just that, they don't have the benefit of the background. All the background work. They're obsolete from the get-go. But they weren't obsolete to the biblical people. They knew all that stuff. Which is why, in the intertestamental period, the New Testament, you get some of the things that you get, okay, in those books and in the New Testament. But this region, again, was just known for, this is the bad place. Not only do we think it's bad, but the Canaanites themselves say, this is, you want to go to the underworld, this is where you go. You want to go, like, get accosted or assaulted, or you want to get visited by, you know, the Rephaim, the spirits of the dead, you know, all the, this is where you go. It did not have a good reputation. Okay, it was a scary place. Bashan also shows up in Psalm 68. O mountain of God, mountain of Bashan. Wait a minute, mountain of God, mountain of Bashan. Why do you look with hatred, O many-peaked mountain, at the mount that God desired for his abode? You know, God, of course, desires Sinai, Zion, you know, Sinai and Zion. Again, I talk a lot in the book about cosmic geography and the cosmic mountain idea. This is where it's ancient talk for the place where God decides to live. Okay. It was Sinai at one point, then it moves, of course, to Zion when they get into the promised land and all that. Well, hey, Bashan, are you jealous? Are you jealous that the mount God desired for his abode? Yes, where that the Lord will dwell forever. The chariots of God are twice 10,000. Thousands upon thousands, the Lord is among them. Sinai is now in the sanctuary. You ascended on high, leading a host of captives in your train and receiving gifts among men, even among the rebellious, that the Lord God may dwell there. Okay, what this telegraphs is the psalmist's desire and almost a forward-looking, this is quoted in Ephesians 4. The language is probably familiar to you. Paul quotes this passage in Ephesians 4, specifically about the crucifixion, the resurrection, and the coming of the Spirit. This is Israelite talk, biblical talk, for one day, God is going to make you Bashan. God is going to make Bashan his dwelling. In other words, he's going to conquer it and dominate it. Okay, it will be under his control. Now, all of that, again, means something. Victory over Bashan meant dominion over Hermon, over the Rephaim, over the evil spirits that are in the underworld. Again, the descendants of the Nephilim, Genesis 6. It meant victory over death, you know, the realm of the dead, the Lord of the dead, the curse of death. It meant the defeat of Baal-Zebul, okay, the devil, all this stuff. This stuff is floating around in the head of Jews who are living when Jesus is around and when the Gospels, of course, get written. Okay, that era, first century. So that some of the things that are described in the ministry of Jesus really are holy war in a spiritual sense. Remember this map a few minutes ago, Bashan, right here? Well, if we take a look a little more closely, here's Sea of Galilee, here is that river, the Pharpar, here's Bashan down here and all the way up here. This is Mount Hermon up here. Jesus goes into this region. He goes specifically to Caesarea Philippi. He's traveling around this region. Here are the Gerasenes. The Gadarene incident is a little bit over here, a little bit down. This is where he cast out devils and things like this, cast out demons. If you want, you know, look at some of these places, I'm going to focus on this one here, Caesarea Philippi, also called Panias or Banias during the Roman period. There was a shrine to the god Pan there. Formerly, there was an altar to Baal right at this location, you know, I don't know, half a mile or whatever it is down the road. That was widely used in the Old Testament. Again, this is the region where Baal is worshipped. This is home turf to him. And up here, of course, is Mount Hermon. So I want to focus on these two places, Hermon and Caesarea Philippi, in the time we have today. Here's a little close-up. You can see they're right adjacent to each other, not too far apart, which is important. And so let's take a look at a few things. In Matthew 16, and of course these other passages in Mark and Luke, we have Peter's confession. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And he says, at this location, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not be able to withstand it. Now, this is a controversial verse. You know, Catholics say, well, when he says, you know, on this rock, he's talking about Peter. So Peter's the first pope, and, you know, that Catholic theology that extends from that. Protestants, of course, say, oh, we can't say that because then we'd be Catholic. so we're going to say something else. Protestants argue that the rock is God or Christ, and they refer to 1 Corinthians 10:4, where Paul, you know, uses that language. I don't think either of them are correct. I think when Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not be able to withstand it, he's standing there with the 12, and Peter, of course, is the ostensible leader. And this rock refers to right where we're standing, and maybe even Hermon, since that's a mountain, that's a big rock. Jesus' point is what? I'm here to begin this thing we call the church, the latest installment of the rule of God on earth, the kingdom of God. And I'm going to build it right over Satan's house. I'm going to make the gates of the netherworld his tomb. This is what I'm going to do. The gates of hell will not be able to withstand it. Now, again, we could go into the grammar of the passage. A lot of your translations say the gates of hell will not prevail against it. You have to supply a preposition in there that isn't in the original text. This is actually a better translation because the verb form is passive. At least the semantics of it are passive. So Jesus goes to this place. Oh, I actually threw this in here. That's good. Against is not in the text. If it says the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, it's just the verb and its object. We see here against, this is a reverse interlinear. You notice there's no Greek word under the word against. That's because there isn't one in the text. It's an empty column. So really what you're dealing with, again, is the church is on the offensive. Jesus is founding the church. And it isn't the church that's in trouble from the gates of hell. It's the gates of hell that's in trouble from the church. I'm going to build it right over his house. It's a very provocative statement. And everybody who knows, again, who's familiar with Bashan in the Old Testament, knows that when Jesus talks about the gates of hell, it's where they're standing. They're right in a region. If they know their Old Testament, they get it. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain. There's only one high mountain in the area, and it's Hermon. Okay, so they go up Hermon, you know, some distance anyway. And guess what happens there? It's the Transfiguration. Now, early church tradition, you'll read in your commentaries, oh, this is Mount Tabor. The earliest anyone ever took that view was in the 4th century AD. It was Augustine's mom. Augustine's mom sort of, I'm not making this up, she sort of fancied herself as an archaeologist. This is the 4th century, and she literally went around to places and said, that's where this happened, and that became gospel. It's the emperor's mom, you don't argue with her, okay? That's what it is. That's what she wants to call it, let's go with it. Right. Anyway, you know, this is a high mountain. Again, this isn't just Mike making up. Here are the references, archaeological works. Hermon's a better choice. Yeah. So on and so forth. I mean, the point is, look at what Jesus is doing. In Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, you know, and I know all the Gospels are different. There are little variations in the chronology and what's in and what's out and all that. I get that. They all had their own audience in mind. They all had their own agendas. We understand that. But in Mark, it's really interesting that he goes to Caesarea Philippi and basically gives Satan a poke in the eye. Guess what? I'm here, and upon this rock, I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell are not going to be able to withstand it. You hear that down there? You know, and then he goes to Mount Hermon, still in the region of Bashan, and he's transfigured, and it's like, this is who I really am. I'm here. Do something about it. And they will do something about it. Because in Mark, it's and Mark's not the only gospel that says this, but after the transfiguration, it specifically says, from this time forward, he began to teach his disciples about his death. He hasn't been going into that. And this is where Peter, like, oh, what? You know, what's all this talk about? You know, we just said this rock thing and you're transfigured, now you're gonna die? Like, what in the world's going on with that? He starts talking about his death. They go down to Jerusalem, that's the next stop. And that's the triumphal entry, and a week later, he's dead. Okay, what does it all mean? What it means is that Jesus goes to these places and he confronts the powers of darkness. He pokes them in the eye. Do something about it. I'm here. Do something about it. Come on. He picks a fight. Because he knows something they don't. It's very evident from the Gospels that when Jesus shows up, they know who he is. I mean, demons are the ones that refer to him as the Son of the Most High, like the people don't, even the disciples don't. It's the demons that get it right. You know, you're the Son of the Most High God, don't pick on us, you know, just that kind of thing. They know who he is, but they don't really know what the plan is. I take what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2 really seriously. When Paul said, had the rulers of this world known, and the rulers of this world is a phrase Paul uses in a couple of his books for the powers of darkness. He said, had the rulers of this world known, they would never have crucified the Lord of glory. Because they're not morons. They're not doofuses, okay? We have, I think sometimes we have this view of demons, you know, like, you know, that the demons have a meeting after Jesus shows up and says, hey, you mean like if we kill him, then that's like the thing that after we do it, that's going to lead to our own defeat? Oh yeah, sign us up. Of course they don't do that. They're not stupid. They know who he is. And they know, okay, if the Father sent the Son, think about the parables as well, you know, I'll send the Son this time, they'll listen to him. You know, the Father sends the Son, okay, that's a big deal. This is the Son of God. This is the Son of the Most High. And so there's only one reason God would do that, and that's like to kick us out and reinstall the kingdom of God, go back to Eden, you know, all this eschatological stuff. And he's a threat. This is the Son of the Most High. So what do we do? What do we do? You know, let's kill him. It seems logical. But that's the very thing that has to happen for it all to work. But they don't know that, because like Paul says, had they known that, they never would have done it, because they're not idiots. But their first impulse, and so, you know, Jesus goes up there and says, okay. I mean, Jesus knows what the calendar is. He knows he's gonna go to Jerusalem, he's gonna fulfill all that triumphal entry stuff, and a week later he's gonna be dead. At least that's what needs to happen. So he goes up here first and starts poking him in the eye. He picks a fight. He provokes the powers of darkness into doing what needs to be done. And they fall for it. They fall for it completely. And in so doing, they sign their own, you know, eviction notice. Because that's how the Gospels are going to play out. They're not counting on a resurrection. They're not counting on, you know, the stuff that we know is the fallout, you know, from all this. But he goes to this place to provoke them. It's the best place you'd go to. It's the gates of hell. Where else would I go? Can you think of a better place? So this is where he goes. But again, we sort of lose the geographical sense. Another thing that he does that I think is really interesting is the sending of the 70. Some of your New Testaments will have 72. It refers back to the same thing in the Old Testament. You know, Jesus begins his ministry and he sends out 70. Well, why would Jesus send out 70 disciples? Well, that the 12, you know, needed a day off. You know, it was like, you know, it was part of the union contract that, you know, we go over here, not there, he sends somebody else. Why does he send 70 or 72? Because there were 70 nations in Genesis 10 that were disinherited at Babel. Remember, the Most High divided up the nations according to the number of the sons of God. Of course, those sons of God turn out to be bad guys. They rebel. They're the ones getting judged in Psalm 82. Where the psalmist ends the psalm by asking God to rise up and take the nations back. This is the beginning of taking the nations back. It's a sign act. New Testament readers in the first century, when the number 70, they know that in the Masoretic text, the traditional text, the number of the nations is 70. In the Septuagint, it's 72. It's because whether you divide or put two names together in Greek, you know, in the translation, that's why you have a variance there, 70 or 72. It all points back to Genesis 10, no matter which number you pick. So pick the one you like. It means the same thing. This is a sign act that Jesus is saying, it is now going to begin. I'm here. I'm going to reclaim the nations. This is my mission. Do something about it. And they go out, they cast out demons. They go, wow, we have power over this. And well, no kidding. It's my turf, and I want it back. And I'm going to take it back. Now, God has decided to use people to do that. God could have taken it back. Jesus could have taken it back in 1 second flat or less. But God likes to use people. He likes to use his imagers, his intelligent, obedient servants to participate in this thing we call the kingdom of God. It's just a highly symbolic act that anyone, again, familiar with the cosmic worldview of the Old Testament would have been familiar with. The number would not have been lost on them. It would have had meaning. Now, if we want to stay on schedule, I'm wondering if I should do this. I could go into some of the signage of Jesus' birth if you want to. You want to do that? I think I could probably do that in 20 minutes. Because there's some really crazy stuff that goes on in there too. Well, let's go. Let's go here. Again, if we need to think of the birth of Jesus theologically, it is the open yet secret, again, as far as the specifics of the plan, arrival of the king. It'll result in the defeat of death, again, the resurrection. It will inaugurate the kingdom of God. Again, reinstall that. It'll initiate the reclaiming of the nations. It's going to begin at ground zero, the gates of hell. Heals the transgression of heaven and earth and all that stuff. But let's pick up some of the backdrop. And again, if you've never heard of this, this might sound a little kind of crazy, a little bizarre. I don't write the stuff, okay? It is what it is, all right? So Romans 10, Paul is talking about the gospel, you know, and about this whole passage about, you know, hey, how are people going to hear unless people go? And he says, how then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without some preaching? Good questions. Paul says, but I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have. And then he quotes the Old Testament. For their voice, and he's quoting from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, because he's writing to the Romans, you know, it's a mixed Jew-Gentile place. Their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Well, who's there? What's he quoting? He's quoting Psalm 19, specifically in verse 4, right here. If you look at it, the heavens declare the glory of God and the sky above proclaims. Well, that's just figurative. Well, maybe. Day to day pours out speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. I mean, in some way, the heavens communicate to us something. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice, and that's what it says in the Septuagint, the Masoretic text has their line, which I'll come back to, goes out through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. Paul, what in the world are you thinking? How are people supposed to know about Jesus from Psalm 19? Like, really? How does that make any sense? Well, it makes sense with this one assumption. And again, I'm going to be honest with you, I'm in the minority here. I know of a couple New Testament scholars that take this passage the way I'm going to show it to you. It's going to sound weird, but it just makes a whole lot of sense. It means what it actually says. John says, "A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And she gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron," quoting Psalm 2 there, a messianic psalm. "But her child was caught up to God and to his throne." Well, when did that happen to Jesus? That's the resurrection and the ascension. Okay. You notice all this language has nothing to do with the primeval rebellion, like before creation. It's clearly associated with the birth of the Messiah. It's just point blank. Well, what does that mean? Well, believe it or not, this is a picture of a zodiac mosaic from a Jewish synagogue in Judea. The Jews believed that since it was God who made the sun, moon, and stars in Genesis, and he made them for times and for seasons, that when we saw the stars move around up there and they went through their cycles, that God was communicating things. Now, this is not astrology like we think of it. This is not, you know, Miss Cleo or whoever the big, whatever. This is, you know, where will I work? Who will I marry? You know, this kind of thing. This is something much bigger. This is Daniel. Daniel had all the knowledge of the Magi, okay, the wise men of Babylon, which included this sort of stuff. But Daniel was a faithful Israelite. So it's not Marduk or some other nitwit, you know, in the Babylonian pantheon that's doing this stuff. It's God is trying to speak to us, and if we know how to, you know, sort of get the message, we can understand that God is up to something, and there's important messaging for us to learn. It's a simple idea. The Creator can communicate through his creation. Here's what's interesting about all this. If you take Revelation 12 as saying exactly what it says about the birth of the Messiah, this is what you get. This is the Milky Way, sun, moon, the line here, remember Psalm 19, their line goes forth. The line is the ecliptic. This is the imaginary line that astronomers use to track the zodiac constellations. Here they are, can't really see the pictures too well, but here's Virgo. Virgo, yes, is a woman with 12 stars at her head. The sun is in her midst. She's clothed with the sun. That's astronomical language of the first century for the sun being in the constellation. The moon at her feet. A little bit isolating here on Virgo. Sun in her midst. Moon at her feet. You'll notice here, and this is not in Revelation 12, but it was in the sky when all these things were true, there is a conjunction here of Regulus and Jupiter. Jupiter was known in the first century as the king planet because it's the biggest one. Makes sense. Regulus was known as the king star because it was the brightest one. They conjoined at this astronomical event. Guess which constellation Jupiter and Regulus show up in? It is Leo, the lion to the Israelites, the lion of Judah. It's the tribe of the Messiah. What a coincidence. Now, for all of these things to be in place, conjunction, Regulus and Jupiter, sun in the midst of Virgo, moon at her feet, there is a 20-day window when all of these things are true. And even more than that, As far as the precision of all this with, again, something else I'll show you, there's actually an 80-minute window you can narrow astronomically. These images, by the way, are from an astronomy program. You can get just a commercial astronomy program. You can plot all this in here and just reproduce it if you want. Now, under her feet, right here, this is just the stick figure drawings. In ancient times, we have here Libra, the scales, and then Scorpio. In ancient times, these were thought and considered to be one constellation. So this scorpion creature with claws is how the two constellations were pictured. It was called the dragon. What a coincidence. Now, there's also another dragon out here that might be the candidate for Revelation 12, but it's not on the ecliptic, but it's really close. Still under her feet, but not on the ecliptic. So take your pick. That's Hydra. So here's the whole picture. There's Leo above the Virgin, sun in her midst, moon at her feet, conjunction of the royal or the king star and the king planet in the constellation of Leo, line of Judah. Again, there was a time window that all of these things could be true, could be correct. 3 BC, are you ready? September 11th. September 11th, 3 BC, is the birth of the Messiah according to Revelation 12. Now that date freaks us out because of our September 11th. But there's actually more to it. Because this day also in the Jewish calendar was Tishri 1. Tishri 1 is the New Year's Day for Jews, Rosh Hashanah, and also the Day of Trumpets. Tishri 1 was New Year's Day in the civil calendar. It was also the day during the monarchy, the Israelite monarchy, that they would inaugurate a new king. What a coincidence. And there's more to it. Again, Jewish calendar, they're kind of like our culture. They use more than one calendar. I mean, we have more than one 365-day calendar. You know, we have a calendar year, we have fiscal years, we have school years, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the Jews did the same thing. They had different calendars. First month of the Jewish calendar is actually Nisan, which occurs in the spring. That's when Passover occurs, because you remember when they came out of Egypt in Exodus 12 here, they marked that as the beginning. They changed how they reckoned their new year. They didn't change the month order, but they reckoned a different new year to commemorate the Exodus. The Bible tells us that. Again, in terms of months, though, the beginning of the year is Tishri. Tishri falls in the fall season. The other one falls in the spring. Tishri is Rosh Hashanah, when the year number changes on the calendar. The concept of different starting points, again, familiar to us. We got new year in January, school year starts in September, fiscal year for churches and businesses could start basically anytime. Still 12 months. Here's where it gets real interesting. Again, these are all things that would have been floating around in a first century Jew's head, because this is what they're taught. This is their tradition. You say, what in the world does the flood have to do with this? Well, here's what the rabbis taught. Genesis 7:6. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. Simple enough. Five verses later, in the 600th year of Noah's life, again, so you know, real close here in verses, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the deep burst forth and the windows of heaven were opened. So it's not hard to see. Noah was 600 years old when the flood began in the month after Tishri, second month. It's easy enough. Remember the dove? He sends out the dove. It doesn't return because the dove finds land. Then we read in chapter 8, in the 601st year, in the first month, that would be Tishri, the first day of the month, Tishri 1, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Now, if you, again, go to a commentary, this whole picture, because it spills into the second month, adds up to more than 365 days. And the rabbis knew this because they could count. So what the rabbis believed was that Noah's birthday was Tishri 1, because he had now become 601 years old, so on and so forth. And they get this from Genesis. So Tishri 1, it's been a year since the flood began, and a little bit more because the second month everything's dry. Noah had therefore turned 601 sometime before the earth had dried out completely. And early Judaism, again, took that to mean Noah's birthday was Tishri 1. Where have we just seen Tishri 1? Jesus and Noah shared a birthday. Again, if you're a Jew, this is how you're parsing this. That would create a mental and spiritual link in the Jewish mind between Jesus and Noah. Now, before we get to that, well, let's just do it. Jesus and Noah. Well, what did Noah's birthday signal? The beginning and the end of the flood, right? Beginning of the flood. Well, that's when God judged the world and the people there. And also, who else? Oh, those forgotten Nephilim from the first four verses of the flood narrative that people just like to skip because they're just too freaky. The flood was viewed as a judgment on them too. I mean, they're to blame for a lot of this stuff. So Noah, the coming of the flood, associated with this, so that when Jesus shows up, the Messiah shows up, born the same day, it's like, okay, just like the flood took care of the problem of evil the first time, or at least that was the purpose, isn't it a wonder that the coming of the Messiah coincides and aligns with the same day? That means it carries the same messaging. He's here to defeat the powers of darkness. Remember those guys, the Rephaim that lived in the underworld with the Lord of the Dead? The Rephaim who were the Anakim who come from the Nephilim, remember that? Okay. All of these thoughts are strung together. They all die if you take an anti-supernatural view of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. They all go away. That's why you haven't heard this before. Now, astronomically, the second month, let's go back here, is marked by the heliacal appearance of the Pleiades. That's when the star rises above the sun, the horizon there. Interestingly enough, the Pleiades in Hebrew, the word is kemah, are mentioned three times in the Old Testament. There you have the references. And they're always paired with Orion, Cassiel. Who's Orion? Why, he's just that old big guy in the sky. Orion was viewed as a giant. So the flood comes when the giant astronomical signaling appears because God is dealing with them. And the same thing happened the second time around. This is just when the Pleiades shows up. So again, if you're a Jew, you're thinking about all this going, really? Like John, did you really like Revelation 12? This was when the Messiah was born. Like, holy cow. You know, that's really something. Job 38, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? This is something I don't have in the book. If you look up Job 38 in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Aramaic Targum, Targums are the Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. For this passage, somehow, the writer of that Dead Sea Scroll translated Pleiades with Naphilah. Anybody remember from the book what Naphilah means in Aramaic? Giant. It's the singular of what would become Nephilim. He must have read your book, Mike, because that's just kind of weird. No, I'm reading his book, and I'm just putting the pieces together. again, all these associations, you know, so when the Messiah shows up, if you're aware of this, or when you read the book of Revelation and you take it as being what scholars refer to as astral prophecy. And I don't believe, I mean, there are some famous believing writers that, I mean, I'll use the word evangelical. I can't remember the dates of Bullinger, but I, you know, he was an evangelical. He's a real Christian as far as accepting the gospel. So I'm using evangelical in the most broad sense possible there. And a guy named Seiss, they've written famous books on the gospel and the stars and stuff like that. One of them is 19th century, early 20th century. I don't believe that you can get the entire Romans Road and the plan of salvation out of this stuff. What I do believe, what I think Paul was thinking in Romans 10, is that, yeah, the whole world could have known that the Messiah had come, a divine king come to earth. They could have known because it was telegraphed in this way. Now, that's not the gospel, but it's the starting point of the gospel. So again, I can't prove it, but I think that's what Paul's tracking on. Because this kind of thinking would have been very common in the educated circles in first century Judaism, of which Paul was a part. Paul was a highly educated, highly literate Jew, taught by Gamaliel and all that stuff. So I think this is what's floating around in Paul's head. And if that's the case, the signage, and again, the symbology of it is really kind of dramatic. You know, there's this connection between the birth of Jesus and Genesis 6, because if you ask, again, this might sound crazy too. Have you ever noticed that there is no place in the Old Testament when the wickedness of humanity is referred to that ever references the fall? Genesis 3. Have you ever noticed that? There isn't a single passage in the Old Testament that references the fall as the explanation for why things are the way they are. There's a reason for that. And Genesis 6:5 is sort of the go-to verse about the iniquity of man being, you know, every thought, every imagination, the thought of his heart, you know, all this kind of stuff. That's the verse, instead of Genesis 3, that's the verse that the Jewish community sees on. If you ask a scholar of Second Temple Judaism or a Jew who's familiar with the material, why is the world the way it is? If you were living in the first century, I can guarantee what the answer you would get. They lay the overspread of iniquity throughout the world at the feet of the sons of God, at the feet of the watchers. They're the ones who messed us up. And we didn't follow the Lord. We followed them. Because in their literature, they talk about this is where people could get secret knowledge. This is where divination came from. This is where necromancy came from. This is where pagan astrology came from. They view Genesis 6:5 as their touch point. They don't think of Genesis 3, they think of Genesis 6:5, right on the heels of the first four verses. So, I mean, I could give you 15 or 20 scholarly articles today that go through all the Dead Sea Scroll material, all the Second Temple material that have the origin of evil in terms of the, you know, how we got this bad, right in Genesis 6:1-4, and including verse 5. But your Old Testament never goes back to Genesis 3 as an explanation, which is why, again, the rabbis latched onto this one. Again, if that's the case, if that's what they're thinking, and there are passages in the New Testament that revolve around that idea that we won't get to today. But if that's the case, the birth of the Messiah is a signal that God is now doing something again to judge evil on a grand scale, on a complete scale, on an exhaustive scale. Because all of that was part of the ruination of the original plan. Eden, where heaven would come to earth, God would dwell with man, we would dwell with him and the divine beings that were with him, the heavenly host. That's why there's plurals in Genesis 1, let us create humankind in our image, all that kind of stuff. We were supposed to be one family with a shared mission on this place, our domain, because we're embodied creatures. And all that goes, you know, proverbially to hell in a handbasket when one divine being corrupts himself, rebels, gets Adam and Eve to rebel, and then Genesis 6, it just sort of just blows up. So when you have the Messiah born sort of as an echo of the first judgment of the bad unseen realm, that really meant something to people. They were tracking with, again, the imagery, the ideas, the concepts, and they could see the messaging. This needs to be dealt with. And we have another person who's better fitted to deal with it here. So this is why you get some kind of strange passages. I've picked out two here. Really one, and this is one of my favorites, 1 Peter 3:22. Why is it when Peter talks about baptism, he links Noah, angels that sinned, the flood, and a visit to the underworld in his discussion about baptism? 1 Peter 3:14 through 22. It's a crazy passage. I think it actually has a fairly, you know, easy explanation if you have this worldview in your head. You know what Peter's doing. Maybe in Q&A we can hit that. But that whole section ends with this statement, where Jesus is at the right hand of God with angels, authorities, and powers having been subjected to him. What does that have to do with baptism? What in the world is Peter thinking? It's why the early church included renunciation of the devil and his angels in their baptismal formulas, because they knew what Peter was talking about. Again, I don't have time right now to get into what Peter was talking about. You can read the book. That's kind of a cheap answer. But yeah, it's true. Maybe if somebody wants to know in Q&A, we can go through it. It doesn't, you know, it might take 10 minutes. We don't have 10 minutes now because we need to break for 10. And then come back and we'll pick up with Acts. Because the Pentecost stuff is kind of neat too. Take 10. Go on.